Chapter 20, Lockjaw, 1939. With children receiving so many vaccines nowadays, it's important to gain some context on where pediatric immunization stood during the 1930s. At that time, the smallpox vaccine was the only medical injection children might have received. Its administration required a strange design, a bifurcated needle not designed to puncture and go deep below the skin, but rather scratch and place the ingredients just below the surface. If someone said their child had been vaccinated, it meant they'd been administered the smallpox immunization specifically, and that alone, because there were no other vaccines in common use. A few had been in development, of course, such as the rabies or anthrax vaccines, but for children in the early 1900s, there was only one shot you might receive for smallpox. It was not as popular as people might imagine. Deaths from smallpox infections had significantly declined since the late 1800s, not only due to improvements in medical care, but also to the natural weakening of the vaccinia virus, which caused the infection. Because of the risks involved, smallpox vaccination was most often performed if and when an outbreak of smallpox occurred nearby. Many parents considered it a preventative measure to be employed in case the alarm was raised, and it never had the carefully coordinated publicity campaigns that diphtheria received. There were no images of the Dion Quince or their early 1900s analog receiving smallpox shots, and as a result, it had never been ingrained as a routine procedure of childhood, much like pediatric vaccines of today. With well-funded diphtheria campaigns rolling nationwide, more parents began to inquire about the procedure. Due to improvements in the manufacturing process, the new aluminum-containing shots had reduced the incidence of serum sickness, and with promises from the nation's doctors that this new injection would work better than anything previous, the concept of a routine pediatric vaccine began to take hold. The responsibility to protect one's child from a diphtheria infection became a noble civic duty, a responsibility so important that if neglected, might get you tossed in jail. Tetanus was different. The bacteria, Clostridium tetani, is an omnipresent microbe which can be found nearly anywhere, particularly where farm animals such as cattle and horses are likely to inhabit. Like diphtheria, it is not the bacteria itself that cause a problem, but the toxin they produce. Outside of the nervous system, tetanus bacteria are an innocuous microbe that cannot harm. Indeed, they are frequently found colonizing the gastrointestinal tracts of animals, thriving without any apparent injury to the host. However, inside the nervous system, the bacteria can multiply and release its toxins, causing extremely painful muscle spasms, a symptom often first noticed by the clenching of one's mouth, otherwise known as lockjaw. Occasionally, the immune system can't get ahead of the infection, and the toxins can multiply to the point that death occurs, a horrible ending portrayed in well-known paintings and illustrations throughout history. If cut by something where tetanus bacteria is present, bleeding itself is often enough to clean the wound. For those who get a deep skin puncture where bleeding is minimal, most are able to clear the infection naturally before the bacteria can gain a foothold. Because of this, tetanus was not something mothers spent much time worrying about, even for barefoot children running around the farm. It had been a concern for soldiers in wartime who were much more likely to suffer a deadly infection, and as a result, development of a tetanus shot had been happening alongside diphtheria. Because of their similarities, protection from tetanus also started with an antitoxin harvested from the blood of horses purposefully infected with the bacteria. This shot would have also generated a nasty reputation for serum sickness, but wasn't in high enough demand to gain any attention, certainly not for children at least. Eventually, a toxoid shot that contained an inactivated form of the toxin was developed and was thought to offer protection against a future tetanus infection. However, it had the same effectiveness problems as the original diphtheria shot, and with the scientific community abuzz with excitement from the incredible effects of potassium aluminum, and more recently, aluminum hydroxide, it was inevitable tetanus would also join the pediatric vaccination club. In a world where injections, particularly for children, were rare, the likelihood parents would subject their kids to an additional 3 shots for an infection most had zero concern about was low. Diphtheria was a relatively easy sell, but for Lockjaw, even the Dion's Dr. Defoe would admit, quote, "Actually, I have never seen a case of tetanus in my vicinity," end quote. There would be no newspaper clippings of the quintuplets receiving a tetanus vaccine. It was simply unnecessary. Faced with this reality, manufacturers decided to combine the diphtheria and tetanus toxoids into one, effectively halving the number of injections required to protect someone from both infections. After testing the new concoction in the Army, the University of California Medical School announced it would begin testing the new blend in children. An effective tetanus antitoxin was available for those suspected of being infected, but this combined shot would give parents no excuse for their children being harmed by the toxin of the Clostridium tetani bacteria. Parents could still opt for the diphtheria-only injection if they insisted, but everyone, doctors, health officials, and manufacturers, were no doubt thrilled with the prospects of combining multiple vaccines into a single shot. There were a few negatives. For the first time in recorded human history, children would be receiving a shot parents didn't actually want. It had been added as a convenience. More importantly, the aluminum-precipitated vaccines children would receive had just doubled. Unfortunately, the effects of an additional source of injected aluminum in children was the last thing on anyone's mind. War had broken out in Europe when the Nazis invaded Poland in an unprovoked attack. In Austria, now under the firm control of Germany, Dr. Hans Asperger was beginning to see more patients with peculiar language abilities. And in Baltimore, Dr. Connor was also busy. Other children were being brought to his clinic by exasperated parents who could find no explanation for their behavior. Something ominous was becoming apparent to the head of childhood psychiatry at Johns Hopkins. Alfred and Donald were no longer alone.